Welcome to Keith Knight. Don't tread on anyone today. I'm honored to be speaking with a Waco survivor, David Thibodeau. You can check out his book, Waco, A Survivor's Story. They just made a show about his book and another book by the FBI negotiator at the compound during the siege. David, thanks so much for your time.
Sure. Let me start off by saying by one of the FBI negotiators the other side is on, because there was 23 different FBI negotiators during the siege. And they try to say in interviews, they try to say that's because, you know, 24 hours, we always wanted an agent available. Well, the truth is, whenever they had an FBI negotiator that was working well with David Koresh and or Steve Schneider, and there was a harmony going, they would take him off and put someone else on. And sometimes it would be someone who was an atheist. I mean, it varied to their degree of personality that the particular FBI negotiator that they would put on that was working with David. But it's funny, Gary Nesner, he was the guy that was early on and was saying, you know, we shouldn't bring David Koresh's vision to come to pass. We should maybe relieve the pressure, take pressure off the situation instead of the tactical commanders putting pressure on the people inside there, which actually, you know, in retrospect for me, because obviously for years I didn't like anyone associated with the FBI, but at least Gary had, I mean, I thought that was, he had the proper way of looking at it. When people were coming out, kids were coming out the first week or so, and some of the older people were coming out, if they had had the foresight to maybe listen to Gary and continue to have the harmony going between the two parties, it may have ended very differently.
Now, during the negotiations, there was one episode where David Koresh made a deal, hey, put this video out and then we'll come out. And David did go back on that deal. Do you feel David was morally justified in doing so?
Well, it wasn't a video. It was a 60-minute audio tape that he had made revolving around the seven seals, but it wasn't really that detailed. Personally, I had studies with David that were far clearer than the 60-minute tape. I mean, I pretty much understand his message, where he was coming from and where he was going, and it made sense to me as a reasonable person. The tape didn't so much. I wasn't too pleased with the tape, but whatever, it's what it is. He still actually did make a deal with them concerning that 60-minute audio. They did say originally that they would play it nationally, and they ended up only playing it on a Christian radio station. So is that why he didn't come out? I don't really know. I don't know what David's reasoning was. He just said that he was told to not come out, that we weren't going to come out yet, that something else had to be done first. And I don't even think he was sure what that was. I don't think until later, when James Tabor and Phil Arnold, two of the theologians that had been monitoring the situation through Ron Engelman's talk show that we were listening to on the inside as well, when they said, you know, David actually does have some kind of scriptural reference and relevance here, and we would be interested in his message and looking at it. When scholars actually said that, David took that very seriously, because before it was like the scholars didn't want anything to do with what he had to say, or he never found the right scholar to talk to. I think he would talk to people that were running seminary schools and stuff, and they were very mad at him because a lot of their students would leave their seminary schools to come and study with David. That happened over and over and over again. But did you have another question? Yeah, you look like
I always ask people what they think the original justification was for the February 28th raid, and I've actually never gotten people to get the correct answer. Now I'm curious, what was their justification for the first raid on February 28th, and what do you think the real reason was?
Interesting. Their justification, well, what they said, that David Koresh had fully automatic weapons. I think, you know, he was taking upper and lower receivers, putting them together, and making semi-automatics into fully automatics. Of course, the original justification, well, there was a lot of people overseas that were getting upset with David because their families were leaving them and coming to study and stay with David. So there was a lot of, but that's not a legal reason, obviously. The legal reason, and, you know, David, and especially I think Paul Fatta, they had a they were, you know, licensed firearm dealers. They went to gun shows. They bought and sold legally. We had yellow sheets on all the firearms. One of the interesting things, if you read through some of the ATF reports, one of the reports says that David Koresh was talking to one of the undercover agents. And he said, look, I'm getting upper receivers from one manufacturer, lower receivers from another manufacturer. I'm putting them together and selling them. He goes, that's not illegal. That's what he told one of the ATF undercover guys. And apparently the undercover guy said it was legal, but David Koresh didn't realize that it was illegal, but it was. And then he cites, of course, the case law for that. So the bottom line is he would have had to pay a special tax on those upper and lower receivers, I believe. So basically they had a reason for an investigation, but David invited them to check out any of the firearms that they wanted to check out through Henry McMahon, who was the firearms dealer. He said, come on in, I'll show you the yellow sheets. They chose not to. They didn't want to go about it that way. David Koresh was the only person on that search and arrest warrant. So let's see, there's 130 people in the building, and it's only David Koresh on the search and arrest warrant. So they definitely could have gotten him. He jogged by the house. They said that publicly that he never went to town or anything. Well, again, their reports prove them to be liars, because in their own report, a few days before the raid, David Koresh and two of the undercover agents across the street went to a firing range about a mile away from Mount Carmel, and they fired AR-15s together. So let's think about that for a second. One of the undercover guys for the ATF takes an AR-15 and shoots at a target and then hands that firearm to David Koresh to shoot at the same target. And that just blows my mind when I read that report. So they were at a firing range with David. They could easily have gotten him then. That's not how they wanted to do it. They wanted a big raid. And they wanted the big raid because of what happened to Randy Weaver and Ruby Ridge 6 months before. And that is, of course, a federal marshal shot Sammy Weaver in the back. Vicky Weaver was killed by an FBI sniper. I mean, it was a big screw-up. And I know that the ATF, they were worried about their budget coming up in Congress, that they were going to lose money and maybe, you know, their big budget meeting was coming up, and they wanted more money. So they figured if they had this big, here's a group of religious people who study and live by the Bible, living in the middle of nowhere, Texas. So if they go on a big attack like this, there's not a chance of civilians other than the people inside the building being hurt. They're easy to demonize because they're a religious group who has firearms, and David Koresh has a lot of kids with different women. So obviously very easy to demonize. There's one of my favorite quotes throughout history is Senator Henry Clay in the 1830s said, the devices of power and its minions are the same in all countries and in all ages. It marks its victim and denounces it, exciting the public hatred so it can conceal its own abuses and encroachments. So I obviously committed that little gem to memory because I thought it was just so perfect. But that's exactly it. You know, if the raid had gone well for them, then they would have showed a bunch of kids coming out of a building, and they rehearsed what to do. The media consultant for the ATF was saying, now, when you come out, make sure your backs are to the cameras so everyone can see ATF, and make sure you're tender with the children when you're bringing them out. And when you bring out the firearms, hold them over your head to make sure that everyone can see, you know. And so they literally rehearsed this. They rehearsed what they were going to do. Unfortunately, the first thing they did was when they came in, they shot the dogs. We had five Alaskan Malamutes who were penned up in an area, could not have hurt the agents. They were behind a fence, and there was a team of ATF people that went right over there to shoot the dogs first. In the trials in San Antonio, one of the ATF agents indicated that the first shots were shot at the dogs, and that when the other agents heard the shots from the team shooting the dogs, they thought it was the people inside. Then they started shooting at the front door. David Koresh had the front door in his hand saying, hold on, there's women and children here. Let's talk about this. And boom, all these shots came at him, and he fell back from the velocity of the bullets coming through that door. And then everyone heard Perry Jones, a 70-year-old unarmed man, screaming, going down from a gunshot in his stomach from the outside forces, and people that were with David at the front door. I was not, but everyone tells me that's when people started to shoot back.
So, okay.
Oh, one more thing, too, about that. Incidentally, the helicopters, they had helicopters on the scene, and those helicopters were shooting into the building too. It shot Peter Gent on a tower, shot Winston Blake, who was eating a piece of French toast on his bunk bed, went right through his window and into his head. I actually saw his body, and I saw the trajectory of the bullet that went through a water tank that was in front of the window. So I can see that that bullet was shot from the air, and I saw that personally. So those helicopters came in firing. Now, it is illegal to use helicopters against civilians in the United States of America unless, under the Posse Comitatus Act, unless you can prove there's a drug nexus of some kind. So they said that the people inside Mount Carmel had a methamphetamine manufacturing plant, which was a blatant total lie. We didn't even drink. We drank once every 6 months, and it was three beers maximum. So that's what, you know, when the Davidians have a party, that's it, it's three beers maximum. So it's like there were absolutely were no drugs at Mount Carmel, and they knew this. You know, they're undercover guys. Robert Rodriguez came to know the people pretty well. Robert actually told his superiors, look, I've seen no signs of legal activity. We need to stop this raid from going forward. And they chose to anyway. That's what I love about the government. They don't even listen to their own people. The people they pay and hire to go in and get the damn information, they don't even listen to them. How, as an agency, do you not listen to your people on the ground when you have that many lives at stake? Cerebin, and these people that okayed this raid, how do you okay an attack on women and children sitting in their beds and you shoot at them for 45 minutes? What kind of people are you? Really, it makes me angry. It's just ridiculous. It goes on and on and on with these people. And then they lie about it. They say, oh, the Davidians fired first. It was an ambush. It wasn't an ambush. They know damn well it wasn't an ambush. And frankly, after 25 years, I'm sick of having to talk about the same crap and have no result whatsoever. You know, it took a six-part series being made for people to finally turn around and say, hey, maybe something else happened to Mount Carmel that I'm not aware of. I've been talking about this stuff for 25 years, man. And you know what? All these ATF guys and FBI guys, they get their pensions. They get to live their nice lives. They get to vacation anytime they want. They're all retired now. Instead of getting punished, they got friggin' raises and promotions. You know what the people that survived here got? 7 years in jail, most of them. On a weapons violation, the jury threw out, no less. I'm ranting a little today. This is actually a fun day. I'm glad we did this in the morning because for some reason I feel particularly good about this. But to tell you the truth, no, seriously, man, I mean, they got, you know, 7 years on a weapons violation that the jury threw out. The judge came back in and said, oh, I'm going to add the weapons violation back in and give these guys 40 years. Finally, it went to the Supreme Court. It took 7 years to get to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court, unanimous decision, said it's one of the worst rulings they've ever seen in all their days. That's Judge Walter Smith. I'll say the name again. Judge Walter Smith is guilty of one of the worst rulings of all time, and it was in the Davidian case, and he did it to protect the government. They've been protecting themselves from day one. They shot into the building on the last day, and they will deny that to their dying day. But I got to tell you, all these agents out there, if there's an agent listening to this, why don't you come to Mount Carmel and talk to me and talk to some of the people out here and apologize for what you did? Why don't you tell us what really happened at the back of the building if you're one of those forces, if you're one of the guys that know? Why don't you come forward? You killed a bunch of kids. You guys gassed a bunch of women and children to death. That has got to bother you. So if you guys, you know, if you want to do the right thing and come forward at this point in history and be on the right side of history, I highly recommend you do so. Because, you know, what really sucks is going to be being on your deathbed and thinking about CS gassing a bunch of kids and realizing what you really did. Why don't you have the nuts to stand up now and be a man and tell people what you really did at Mount Carmel? Because frankly, I'm sick of it, dude. I'm sick of 25 years of everyone thinking that the people inside set that fire and that they shot each other at the final stages. You know what? Maybe some people were shot. Maybe some people were trapped and they shot themselves to escape a fire. I don't blame them. The only reason I came out of the building is because I didn't want to burn to death. I figured the forces shooting me would be a much better thing. But I'm telling you, I'm pretty sure there was fully automatic weapons fire at the back of that building that was coming from the outside forces into the building. And I also, on that infrared, have noticed two explosions at the back of the building in the gym area where one of the fire begins. One of the three fires begin at the back of that building. Now, there were three. We found four pyrotechnic devices in the evidence locker in Austin, Texas. investigator Mike McNulty, who was doing The Rules of Engagement, which is an excellent documentary. I highly recommend it. It was nominated for an Oscar. It features the FLIR tape at the end, and you can see the fully automatic weapons fire, which the government says is sunlight reflection. And to this day, they swear by it, sunlight reflection. When I see it, I see something very, very different, and it's much more sinister. So, okay, you know, that was my rant. I will go back to the questions. Basically, we just covered the entire thing in that one little question of yours. And again, I'm sorry. I slept really well last night. I feel like I'm on fire this morning. I'm glad we didn't do this last night.
No problem at all. So I want to be clear. So David was the only name on the arrest warrant. Correct. They could have arrested him while he was jogging or while he was at a bar named Chelsea's. You went through that on Mance Raider show. I don't want you to have to go through that again.
How about when he's shooting guns with the agents?
Yeah.
That's a pretty good story. That's a pretty good time to arrest him right there. Three guys alone in a firing range shooting guns. They handed him a gun, my friend. Not only did they not arrest him, think about that. The ATF handed the notorious, the criminal mind, that mastermind, David Koresh, they handed him a firearm and shot with him. Think about that. This is a guy they're scared of. This is a guy they're investigating. Who hands their enemy a gun? It blows my mind when I sit down and I think about that.
So I just want to be clear. According to a book, No More Wacos, by David Capel and Paul Blackman, they said David Koresh invited the ATF agents into the compound. Is that what happened?
Okay, here's what he looked. Kind of. Yes, actually, yes, because the undercover agents came over every day. Robert Rodriguez came over every day for about a month. Yeah, he got to know the people. He sat in on studies with David. He often sat in the foyer. Rodriguez actually brought over a gun that he said he bought at a, okay, he said he bought it at a, what was it, a gun show, and then David put the gun apart, took it apart in less than like 30 seconds right in front of him. It was great. I saw the look on his face. It was ultimate surprise. And David took this gun apart. He goes, oh, look at that. He goes, look at that there, Robert. The trigger here, or I don't know how guns, honestly, the inner workings of firearms. But he said the trigger here has been, filed down. So that made it full auto. He goes, this is an illegal firearm, Robert, and I wish you wouldn't bring that over to my house. He goes, that's a legal firearm, so I hope you should have known what you were getting here, and I would take that back because that's illegal unless you have the proper yellow sheet. And he actually was schooling the ATF guy. So he was well aware of what was going on there and that Robert was trying to bait him, basically. But, yes, the answer is yes. They were invited in, and they came into Mount Carmel several times. I can't even count the amount of times they were at Mount Carmel.
So in episode 3 of the show that is based on your book, 20 minutes in, it shows that there's a blockade of the compound after the February 28th raid, and they actually shoot and kill one of the husbands trying to come in to see his wife. Did that happen?
Yes, it did. That was Michael Schroeder. Michael Schroeder was working at another business that was owned by David called the Mag Bag, and it was an auto kind of auto repair place. It was a garage. That's what I'm trying to say. And he was working there. Of course, you know, his wife and his kids were in Mount Carmel, so he was trying to sneak back in that evening. And I guess he was with two other people who were captured, but for some reason with Mike, it was a firefight, or at least they shot him. But the bottom line is his cap, the cap disappeared. It wasn't into evidence. And he was shot at close range. He was shot execution style in the back of the head. And the autopsy report showed that there was no gunpowder residue, so it couldn't have been at a short range is what they tried to say. But his cap was missing. I mean, let me put it this way. There's always something. Whenever all these experts, I swear to God, all these PhDs that they haul out, I call it piled higher and deeper is what PhD stands for as far as I'm concerned. Because all these experts, they just have a much better way of expressing how a certain thing could not have taken place. Yeah, if you're going to take the guy's cap off, of course there's not going to be gun residue, you dumbass. Sorry, dude, but again, it's 25 years of this crap, the cover-up that's been going on here. They take the guy's cap off and they say, oh, there's no gun residue, so therefore the ATF couldn't have shot him at close range. They did shoot him at close range, and I am so sick of these people covering their ass. That's all it is cover your ass. Cover your ass, cover your ass, cover your ass. You know, these people are they shot for 45 minutes a bunch of women and children on the second story of the, and that's, I can't believe one of the kids wasn't killed. That's a miracle in itself.
Now, according to, this is another tactic of smearing other people. There was like the babies in incubators lie in the Gulf War. There was the babies on bayonets in World War I. And Janet Reno has the babies being beaten, which according to her testimony, she later redacted according to the New York Times. Was that the ultimate justification, Reno having those words, being able to go in on April 19th?
No, I mean, is it a justification? Maybe for them.
Oh, yeah, yes.
That's all they had. That's like George Bush saying there's weapons of mass weapons of mass destruction, so we need to go and invade Iraq. You know, they're, wow. You know, it's funny how America was supposed to be so intelligent and so, I don't know, you know, we're supposed to be so proud of our freedom. How we really like going to war. That's what it seems like, because we allow people to lie to us and allow an amazing force to go in and just wipe out a bunch of friggin' farmers. That's basically, you know, when we're going into war, the majority of the people we're killing are civilians at this point, especially in something like Iraq. We defeat their military forces very quickly, and then it's just, oh, it's just chaos, man. It never ends. It's, you know, as long as we shouldn't be going to other places killing people, but let's get back. I'm getting sidetracked. Let's get back to the point. Janet Reno. No, that wasn't a justification as far as I'm concerned. The kids weren't being beaten. Some of the kids were spanked. And everyone knows that a lot of religious groups, spare the rod, spoil the child, have been spanking their children for thousands and thousands of years. It's a form of punishment. Personally, I don't spank my kid. I don't want to terrorize my child. And some people agree with me. Some people don't. But a spanking is a spanking. I would say that the kids here were incredibly well behaved. You could take them out to public. They didn't act like little jerks running all over the place. They were incredibly well behaved. They were good kids. They were happy kids. They had homeschooling. They went to school every day here. They played together. They shared together. They were. I saw just wonderful children here. So okay, I didn't think. Nothing, there was no, I didn't see any child abuse, let's put it that way, okay? And I saw the evidence of the way the parents were raising the children, and it seemed to work here. So, that being said, the only people that beat the children was the federal government. And they didn't beat the kids, they gassed the kids. They used CS gas, which by its own manufacturer is a riot control agent. If you read the manufacturer's instructions, it's a riot control agent to only be used outdoors, never indoors, never inside a building. CS gas is a powder. The way that it spreads is through methylene chloride. The delivery method is methylene chloride. Guess what methylene chloride is used in? Paint thinner. Methylene chloride is flammable, folks, and that's the delivery method for CS gas. Now, CS gas is a powder. What happens when you have subatomic particles floating through the air together? It can cause an explosion. I'll give you an example, a grain silo. It's the subatomic particles of dust in a grain silo that can cause it to, if it catches fire, to go up like a fireball. It's the same thing with CS gas. That's why whenever CS gas is used in a building, there's five or six different examples. The building catches fire, folks. Oh, boy. I know a lot of people are probably, your audience, some of them are younger, are probably hearing this for the first time. I've just been saying it for 25 years. So it's like, it's cool. The CS gas riot control agent only be used outdoors, and they used a two-day supply of CS gas in 6 hours. They were frustrated because of the high winds, and we would open the window, and a lot of the high winds were blowing a lot of the CS gas out of the other window in the chapel area where I was. I can only speak for my area. I don't know what's going on in the other area. I can tell you one thing, though. All the women and children were put in the walk-in cooler, which had survived a fire in the 50s. They were all put in there under wet blankets to try to it was the only place they had to go. When the tanks went through the building on April 19th, they blocked off the escape that led to the underground bus. They actually collapsed a wall on top of that. They went through where I was, the chapel area, and I saw the tank come through the front doors and move the doors backwards. I can't describe to your listeners what it's like to watch your front door come at you and have to jump out of the way because a tank has come through your front door and moved it into the living area. I can't really describe what that's like, but I got to tell you, it's absolutely horrifying. And then they went into the center of the building. They put a big hole in the center of the building and all the way back to where the walk-in cooler was. And I have pictures of this at Mount Carmel that I show tourist groups that come here. And so they went all the way back to where the women and children were in the walk-in cooler. They put a turret in there, and they delivered on a massive amount of CS gas. And actually, the tank driver said that he delivered a massive amount of CS gas into the walk-in cooler. That's where the women and kids were. They literally suffocated the kids to death with CS gas. Once the fire started, CS gas, when it burns off, it burns into cyanide. Believe it or not, everyone can look this up for themselves if you don't believe me. CS gas burns into cyanide. Some of the kids had such a high tracings of cyanide poisoning in their bloodstreams that it caused their muscles to contract and bow backwards. And a couple of the children, autopsy report showed that. Not only, let's talk about the beatings again. You know who else beat the kids? The tank. When the tank hit the top of the structure, some of these huge chunks of concrete fell in on them and crushed them to death. Some of the kids died of blunt force trauma. The blunt force trauma is from chunks of concrete hitting them. When the report came out, the Justice Department report came out, they got on the national news, and I remember watching this. They got on the national news, and they said, our report will find, in the final moments of the Branch Davidian conflagration, the Davidians beat and stabbed their children to death. They said that we beat our kids to death. That's how they spun it, S-P-U-N. They spun it. The way that they win the media war is by spin. We know what spin is? Spin is lying. When they're spinning something, they're lying to you, so they will get you to agree to what they're doing. Again, it's that Senator Henry Clay quote. It denounces its victims, exciting the public hatred, so they can conceal their own abuses and encroachments. So they can conceal the evil that they've done to the place and the people here. And they turn it all around and make the people here look like they're some kind of demons. Frankly, I'm sick of it. The people that died at Mount Carmel were some of the best people I've ever known. And they just didn't deserve the rap that they've had for the last 25 years. So you know what? Yep, I'm sick of it. These people get away with it. It's time for them to go to jail. If they're not going to go to jail, they need to live with their conscience, and they need to know what they did. You gassed and killed a bunch of kids. Way to go, federal forces. Way to go, you tough guys. You guys that claim that you're there to save people. You gassed a bunch of kids to death, and you're blaming it on us. I'm sick of it. Shame on you. There. Okay, I'm good. I'm off my soapbox now.
Yeah. Well, Bill Clinton said Reno shouldn't resign just because some religious fanatics decided to murder themselves.
Yeah.
I want you to go through some of the propaganda used to dehumanize the Branch Davidians. I know you got into it there, but is that the extent of it?
Oh, no. They changed the wording completely. You know, and there's – what was it I was watching recently? Oh, I just watched the movie Vice about Dick Cheney, which is very interesting, because they did the same thing with global warming. They call it climate change instead of global warming because climate change sounds better. You know, these are kind of things, these words that are in our vernacular now, used over and over by the media on purpose. They directly use this so they can spin things. In our case, it wasn't a tank that was going through the front door, but it was a CEV. Because the tanks had the turrets taken off and it was a CEV. Well, guess what? Right here at Mount Carmel, If you guys come check out Mount Carmel someday, I have a picture of a tank of Bradley Fighting Veal with the turret on it in front of the burning building. So there were tanks here. Again, just another lie. So the tank was a CEV instead of a sniper. They didn't have a sniper in a sniper position, but he was a forward observer. So they call the sniper a forward observer. What are some of the other ones? Of course, firearms or weapons, if it suits them. If it suits them on the other side, they're firearms. One of my favorites is when they threw a flashbang grenade in. A flashbang grenade doesn't explode, okay? It performs a rapid expansion of gases. That's what they call an explosion. In other words, a pyrotechnic device. It doesn't explode, but it performs a rapid expansion of gases. That's literally how ridiculous it gets, and it goes on and on.
Now, in the show, they say that you married David's wife. Did that happen?
It actually didn't happen. I'm pretty – on the book, I talk about this pretty succinctly. It was kind of mentioned that – we should get married to try to kind of keep the forces at bay for a little while longer while he was working on some stuff. And it was, frankly, you know, David was a very, very deep individual, and I learned a lot of things from him. I learned the seven seals from him. But that's the one thing in my 2 years of knowing the guy that he asked me to do that I never felt right about. And I did it just because it was my group. I wanted to protect the group, and I wanted to protect Michelle and Serenity. So, yeah, we said we were married, but we didn't act, there wasn't actually a there wasn't a ceremony. Yeah, there wasn't a ceremony. It was nothing like it was in the film. In the film, they made it was this big ceremony. And we had, you know, we had parties like that where everyone got together and danced, but it wasn't like a wedding ceremony or anything like that. But it's just kind of how it worked out.
And was that because she was underage when he was first with her?
Yes.
Okay. There is a really interesting part in the documentary where the lawyers actually come in and they say, look at that door. Look at that ceiling. You guys have a great case. Talk to me about what it was like when the lawyers came into the compound during this 51-day siege.
Well, for me, it was actually very exciting to have people that I guess are representatives of the system, even though they're your defense attorneys. They're still, you know, wards of the court. They're still people that are, I guess, looked highly upon, and their testimonies, especially Jack Zimmerman, who was a veteran. He was a veteran. I'm not sure. I can't remember what branch he was in, but you know, these people saw the evidences that we had been talking about, and they were able to corroborate that with us. So that was great. I remember feeling very hopeful that they had come in. And I'm surprised, actually, that more wasn't done. At that point, I wish David would have listened to them and said, okay, we got a good case. We should take it there. I'm really hard on what the government did here because, yes, they gas kids and they blame it on us. They're the ones that gas the kids. But you know what? In doing the research for my book and being an honest, rational, thoughtful individual, I have to say David Koresh made some mistakes. He made some mistakes along the way, absolutely. I think at the point that the attorneys came in, he should have considered going out more. I know that he wanted to wait until the seven seals were written down. I get that. And that's a plan that came after the attorneys had come in. But I felt very hopeful with the attorney's testimony and telling us that we had a pretty good case, that we should go that route. And I think Steve did as well. Anyway, David chose not to go that route. I wish he would have. I consider that a mistake on his part, frankly.
Now, when I watched Rules of Engagement, they said that the front door of the compound that was brought into evidence is still missing. Is that true?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There was two double doors, and they were metal doors. The one with the most bullet wounds coming from the outside in, and you could see clearly that there was that all those bullets were coming from the outside in. That's one of the things Dick DeGaren testified to. I think at the congressional hearings, they were asked for those doors. Oh, no, I'm sorry. Excuse me. Oh, yawning. Early morning yawn. the two doors, one of them was entered into evidence and the other one wasn't. And when they were asked where that second door was, that was the door that had all the bullet holes in it. And the FBI said, oh, that must have disintegrated in the fire. A metal door. Its twin door was there, entered into evidence. The other door wasn't. So it didn't disintegrate in the fire. It was hidden. It was, you know, I always think of that scene. I always think of the, sorry guys. Can you still hear me?
Yes, I can.
Sorry, I had a call come in. I always think of that scene in Raiders of the Lost Ark, that last scene where they're taking the Ark of the Covenant and put it in some big warehouse in the middle of nowhere, you know? Some giant, huge government warehouse. That's probably not the case, but that's just a kind of a funny little visual. So, yeah, you know, I mean, I'd love to go to that warehouse where all this stuff is hidden. But, yeah, definitely, I think they hit it. That door didn't disintegrate in a fire. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, because as the guy was saying in Rules of Engagement, if that's where the shooting started and there's only shooting going in, well, then that's pretty much against their case. And it made it seem like that's what the lawyers were saying in the show.
Yes.
One thing that I learned in this is that 23 people actually left the compound during the siege. In other words, far from being held down against their will, there were 23 people who left. Now, if I'm looking at this as an observer, I say, okay, right or wrong, ATF, it doesn't matter. Just come out and this could have ended peacefully. How do you respond to people who say that?
Oh, you mean just come out? Or yes, some people did come out during the siege, like you said. Problem with that is when other people would be coming out and then they would put the pressure on, okay, now we got some, let's get them all, bring them all out now, or there's going to be a consequence. And our attitude was like, listen, people are coming out, the negotiations are going harmoniously, why are you putting the pressure for everyone to come out? Not everyone's going to come out now, and you're scaring us. And then they'll be like, oh, we'll show you, and the tanks would come onto the property and run over one of the vehicles. Or they would tip over the 500-gallon gas tanks that we had on tripods near the building. They would tip those over. I'd sit there and watched the fuel pour out onto the ground next to the building. I saw that happen. So it's just amazing. I mean, this is their forces, that every time things would go harmoniously, they would put pressure on, and that would cause a mistrust, and people would back off. People didn't want to go out to that. Nobody wanted to go out to that kind of aggression. You know, the agents would sit on the tanks and moon us, and they would give us the finger and moon us. And, you know, these are the kind of forces that are asking us to come out. No. It's just ridiculous. And it's something that people don't understand. Every day during the siege, there was a press conference. And during the press conferences, sorry, I need a drink of water. During the press conferences, the government would be like, oh, the cult this, the cult that. David Koresh is just Bible babble and God's talking. All they did was demonize the people inside. Instead of saying, oh, we had a really, you know, a really good conversation with David and treating him as a person, treating the people in there as people, they kept calling us this cult, this cult, this cult, this cult, this cult, this cult, over and over and over again. So it's like they're just painting a picture for the American public they want to paint while trying to tell us that they have our best interests. Can you imagine that? Can you imagine someone telling you that they really want to help you and they want to make sure all you guys get out okay and that, you know, they're here to help you? And then that same person goes and does a press conference and says, oh, these cult members, and they're really being unreasonable. They're saying, oh, you guys should just come out. We really want to help you. Hey, this cult here, these guys are a cult, and this cult and the cult and the Davidian cult and David Koresh, the cult leader, over and over and over again. So they would say one thing to us, and then they would say a direct opposite or another thing to the American public. That went on for 51 days. Guess what, guys? That's going to cause a massive amount of mistrust. Let me give you a bottom line, okay, if you don't mind. I think – oh, I got to be careful here. No one wants to look at it this way, but I'm going to throw it out there. I think that spiritual things took place here, and everything David said was going to happen came to pass. Now, he said to me 6 months before this raid, and this is 93, tanks and helicopters had never been used against American citizens before. My father is a history teacher, retired. So history has been in my life. I have studied the Constitution. I have studied the Revolutionary War, the Civil War, the causes thus for both Vietnam, World War I, World War II. I have a pretty good understanding of this stuff. Even at a young age, I was on a roof with David, and he said, "What are you going to do, Tibbs, when there are tanks running up and down the Double E Ranch Road?" And I said, "David, I don't care what you're doing or what you think you're doing or how bad you think you are or what the government, the big bad government's going to come in on us because you're teaching the seven seals." And that's the way that he looked at it, that because he was teaching the seven seals, the message would be fought against and destroyed. I said, "They're never going to use tanks on this property against citizens." 6 months later, I'm watching tanks go up and down the Double E Ranch Road. He told Kathy Schroeder, "Kathy, what are you going to do when there's helicopters buzzing the building?" Kathy Schroeder said the same thing. "Dave, they're never going to use helicopters against this group of people. It's not how it's done here in America." 6 months later, there are helicopters buzzing the building. As a matter of fact, the worst case of my PTSD was after everything happened and I got back to Maine, I would hear a helicopter. And next thing I know, I would wake up and I would be under the bed. Every time I heard a helicopter, I would kind of black out and I would open my eyes and I would be under the bed. So for some reason, that was the triggering thing, was a helicopter. A helicopter always made me hit the floor and look for cover. And it was just a very weird reaction. But it happened to me a couple times before I got used to the fact that, okay, that's just a civilian helicopter and I'm not in a war zone anymore.
Yeah. So
did that answer your question?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. So
I noticed that I'm going off on these tangents and I don't know if I'm actually answering your questions.
Oh yeah. So I have a source that says after the fire, an ATF agent put the ATF flag on the Branch Davidian pole. Did that happen?
Yeah, but it wasn't just an ATF flag. It was the ATF flag, and then above that was the Texas state flag, and above that was the American flags. So they put three flags on the pole, like they had won a war, yes.
So here is episode 5 of the Waco show. Now, you're watching it, and you're like, okay, if you didn't have any history, why are they obsessing over these people? All right, there was a firefight, but whatever, just move on. Why are you spending all this time and all this energy? And here's money. And money, yeah. And here's what the show says. The FBI agent goes, 5,000 to one, those are the odds against us. 5,000 people to every one officer of the law. You know how we keep order with those odds? Because people believe we're more powerful than we are. We project strength, and the people believe in that strength. When we sit outside a place like this for weeks on end, waiting for them to tire, we look weak in front of the rest of the world, and every a-hole with a bomb kit starts getting ideas. This is more than a situation now, Gary. This is a symbol. Are we the kind of agency that coddles cop killers? Do you think that is the mentality that was put into them, which allowed them to justify the atrocities that took place at Mount Carmel?
Oh, it certainly sounds right. I mean, it has a ring of truth. I hear certain things, and it has that ring of truth, or that flat sound that rings to be not true. That has a ring of truth to it to me. Yes.
Yeah.
Do I know for sure? No, I don't know for sure, but the attitude that I get from these guys is a lot of them were very good football players in college that didn't make the pros and are really pissed off about it. They're just a bunch of macho guys that want to use their toys, and they got an excuse, and they're going to take full advantage of it. That was the attitude. When you're on a tank, and you know there's a bunch of women and a bunch of old ladies and a bunch of kids in the building, and you pull your pants down and spread your butt cheeks apart, That's the kind of mentality, you know, man. That's not a professional. That's not professional, guys. You're the FBI, and I don't care if you're the leader of the FBI or a hostage rescue team guy or a negotiator. There's a certain amount of professionalism, and probably mooning a bunch of kids and giving them the finger isn't the most professional thing you can do. You look like a disgruntled college student. You look like an idiot when you do crap like that. And you need to be called on it. So here, I'm going to call you. I saw it. I'll call you on it. You did it. You guys, oh, it just makes me crazy. These are the forces. These are the people that we look to. And that's the thing. You know, the FBI, they're good at what they do when it comes to getting bank robbers. And, you know, they have protected the American people on many occasions from some disasters that could have taken place. So it's not like they're not good at their jobs. But they're really good at their job. So when little brother screws up, big brother knows how to use the words to justify the actions of little brother. And I think that's kind of what has happened here.
Sure. I just thought that was an interesting insight into the mindset of, oh, that's what the average, that's what's going through their minds. Because it's rough to, you know, sympathize with, you know, with them during this thing. What were your overall thoughts during the negotiations? Were you happy? Did you think one side was getting wrong? Did you think there were stubborn people? Did you think there was a really good thing that could have happened but didn't follow through? What were your general thoughts during the negotiations?
Yeah, there were times the negotiations were going well. I think that we worked well with Gary. And maybe I think there was one or two other negotiators that David actually liked, but they would take, like I said, they would take them off and put someone else on that, you know, didn't work so well with David, or maybe was more confrontational. And they were trying different things. And I wondered why they would. I always wondered, why would they do that? Why would they take the person that was working well with us off the case unless they wanted the outcome that they ended up getting, which was the place burning to the ground? Let's face it. The government benefited from the place burning to the ground. I'm sorry, but they benefited from it. All the bullet wounds in the ceiling from the helicopters, the bullet holes in the doors. And, you know, who's not to say that this evidence wouldn't have still disappeared? It probably would have still disappeared even if the place had stood. But it would have been better for us had the place stood. And it definitely benefited the government for the place not standing and burning to the ground. So, I mean, you know, I think that's true. That's a true statement. Absolutely.
Now, here is from episode 6 of the series. A radio broadcaster says, "The FBI and Branch Davidians each claim the other started the fire, and we may never know the truth." Now, before that, Bill Clinton is the one, that was him, who said, "Just because some religious fanatics decided to murder themselves, Reno should not resign." The guy in the show then says, "We may never know the truth, so instead, let's talk about what we do know. Fact, Fresno, California, 1973, a standoff with law enforcement ends when tear gas turns to fire, killing those inside. Fact, Los Angeles, 1974, standoff between SLA and law enforcement ends when tear gas turns to fire, killing those inside. West Fork, Arkansas, 1981, a standoff, tear gas, fire, death. 1983, Smithfield, Arkansas. 1985, Philadelphia. 1987, Escanado, California. All of them, standoff, tear gas, fire, death. The FBI knows this and yet made no plan to put out the fire if it started." You think that everyone inside was murdered intentionally?
Murdered intentionally. Okay, that's wow. Yes and no. Here's why I say that. I don't think that every FBI agent wanted the outcome of what happened in Mount Carmel. I think a lot of the agents on the ground had no idea what was going on. I think the agents on the ground didn't know what CS gas did to a building if it was used inside. I could tell by the two FBI agents that I came in contact with after exiting the building, when the place is burning and they're looking frantic and scared, and I see the fear in their eyes from the place burning and the kids literally dying, that they were horrified by that. I saw that. So, yeah, no, I don't think that's the outcome that they wanted, but I think that the people that were making the decisions that day knew what was going to happen. Why else would you put the huge holes in the building causing an oxygen flow system? By wrecking the building and having the tanks go through, that's what they did. That building was ready to go up like a pot-bellied stove, is some of the analogies that have been used. The amount of CS gas used are awesome. Why would they have pyrotechnic devices in there? Period. There were 4 pyrotechnic devices that were found. If you don't want that building to go up, why would you, what's the word, invite the controversy by having pyrotechnic devices in there at all? And as a matter of fact, they denied it for years. And then finally they had to say, oh yeah, well, we did have pyrotechnic devices in there, but the Branch Davidians still started the fire. Let's talk about one more thing too. Let's talk about the audio tapes of the people saying, spread the fire, light this, put some there, do that. You've heard this. Most people have heard this. It's been on, it was featured on the NPR documentary about about Oklahoma City. And that's when they brought that in. That just blows my mind, because they played those tapes for me when I was sitting before the grand jury, and I couldn't tell what was being said. And then they gave me something that they typed down that said, start the fire, do this, put some here. And they're trying to tell me that that's what's being said on the tapes. And I'm like, that's not what I heard. I heard cut the power, not light the fire, when I listened to the tape in the headphones they were playing it for. And then they would say, well, why would they say cut the power? And I'd say, I don't know, maybe because of the generators, I don't know. But that's what I hear. Now, here's what troubles me about the tape. The FBI says that those tapes were taken at 6 a.m. the day of the fire. That those recordings, where they're saying spread some here, put some here, are taken at 6 a.m. If those tapes were taken at 6 a.m., then why did the fire not start till 6 hours later? 12 o'clock is when the fire started. If the people inside set that fire and those tapes prove that they set the fire, then why did it take 6 hours for the fire to start? Number one. And this is their own. I mean, if the FBI had never said those tapes were taken at 6 a.m., I think their case would have been more compelling. But they say the tapes were taken at 6 a.m. And then when they were asked, well, if you knew that the Davidians were spreading fuel, why did you go forward with the raid? And then they said, we didn't know that. We couldn't hear what was being said until we got the tapes back to our labs in Virginia and scrubbed them. The FBI term, scrubbed. They had to scrub the tapes to find out what was being said. Now, if anyone has seen, there's a movie that I think is really good. It's called Primal Colors, the one with John Travolta, and it's loosely based on the Clinton campaign. There's a scene in there where basically through audio manipulation, they make Larry King sound like he's hitting on a woman when he's just ordering when he's just calling and getting a reservation. It's an interesting scene because it shows how easily audio tapes and cell phone communications can be manipulated. And that was back in the 90s that this movie came out. I believe it was the 90s. So that was before all the kind of technology we have today. It's very easy to manipulate phone conversations and recordings and things like that. Am I accusing them of that? No. I think that it's entirely possible, however. I don't know for sure if that's what they did, but they did say that they had to take their tapes back to the lab and scrub them. That's their words, not mine.
So I think it's definitely important to get this message out. And as you said, it's been a rough 20-something years doing it. I'm curious. You talk, I don't want to know if it's, I'm not sure if I should have it coming from you, but the average person does think ATF just went in, just walked in, you guys started shooting, there was a 51-day standoff, and then when they came in, you said, you know what, before they get us, we're going to light ourselves on fire. That is the general consensus. What is your elevator pitch to someone who has that idea and you want them to think differently about what happened?
Just look at the facts, man. All you got to do is do a little research. Find out if half of the things I've said in this interview are true, you guys should be scared out of your mind. You know, you guys should really review the things that the media, the things you believe from your press and from your news agencies, you should be terrified. Because you know what? You're being lied to on a daily basis. And if you don't see that, then you kind of deserve what you get because you're living in your ignorance. Everything I say to you, everything I've presented, I believe to be true 100%. Everything I presented, I present because I have pictures. I have the audio. I've thought about it. I've seen the things that they say, and I know what the truth is because I was there. I'm not saying, look, I'm not getting rich doing this, guys. This is not, I would much rather be playing drums with a band than doing this and having to talk about this. But I am just, I got to tell you, the older I get and the more these documentaries that I come out that I see on TV that don't get the story right, it makes me crazy. When I see that A&E documentary and it's really good, they're interviewing David Koresh's stepbrother and he's talking about, you know, they're interviewing people that were involved. And I'm like, oh my God, they're really getting the other side here. And then they get to the end. And at the end, they say, well, it's too bad that people set the place on fire. They're still, oh my God, they're pretending to be unbiased, but they're not. They're not talking about the fully automatic weapons fired at the back of the building, people being shot trying to escape. They're not talking about the explosions we have on infrared videotape from the sources of one of the fires at the back of the building. They don't mention that. What they say is the people inside started the fire, and it goes on and on and on, and they're just not talking about the other side. They're not talking about the reality of what really happened. That just blows my mind, man. It doesn't end. To this day, they're putting out ill communication. You know, it's really funny. I'm glad, actually, that you brought that up. I was thinking the other day about Byron Sage, who was interviewed in that documentary, and he said, you know, during the fire, I don't understand why those people didn't bring out the children. One of the people brought out a dog, but not his own daughter, who died in the fire. That's just malicious and unfair. He's talking about Clive Doyle. Now, Clive Doyle is one of the nicest men you'll ever meet in your life. Clive Doyle came out of the same hole I did. He was in the same area of the building I was in. His daughter was in the other area of the building. The tanks destroyed any kind of avenue of him getting to Cherry or me getting to Serenity because I tried to, and the tanks had destroyed it. There was no way to get down the hallway. It was impossible. You couldn't do it. A dog followed Clive Doyle out of the building and out of the fire. Clive didn't bring the dog out of the fire. The dog was smart enough to get out and followed him. And then Byron Sage to say that, why did no one bring out any children? You know why, Byron? Because you took a tank into the front of the building and you gassed them to death. You gassed them to death. You gassed those kids to death. Shame on you, to your everlasting contempt, to sit there and lie to the American public the way you did. The kids didn't come out because they couldn't. You gassed them to death, my friend, and you blame us for it. Shame on you, Byron Sage. Oh, and incidentally, we have two pictures hanging up right now in the sanctuary here that show Byron Sage coming out and posing for a picture while the building's burning in the background. Not one. He said on national television once, I wasn't posing for a trophy picture. I came out and someone took that picture. He was very offended that someone would call him on it. Guess what? We don't have one, but we have two pictures. We have a picture of the place burnt starting, I would say maybe 5 minutes in, 10 minutes into the burn. And then we have another picture of him posing in a different area with a building in the background totally burnt to the ground. So he didn't pose once, but twice. And then he's going to sit there and lie to me and lie to the American public and say that he didn't pose for a picture. You want to play that game, buddy? We got the evidence. You come to Mount Carmel, you can see it for yourself. I'm sick of them lying to the American public. Just lying and then, you know, calling me a liar. Whatever, dude. You can say what you want. I got the truth on my side. I can live with myself, Byron Sage. All you hostage rescue team guys, you tough guys. I don't know how you can live with yourselves killing a bunch of kids. Killing women and children, whatever. I can look myself in the mirror. Shame on you.
Again, David's book is Waco, A Survivor's Story by David Thibodeau. Last name spelled Thibedeau. I got two.
It's B-O-D. Thibodeau.
Bodeau. I'm sorry.
That's cool.
So two softballs for you. Who is your favorite drummer of all time?
Ooh. I have three. I have four. Yeah, okay. I got bits of Buddy Rich, Neil Peart, John Bonham, and Akira Jimbo. Probably not in that order, but whatever. They're all amazing.
Have you seen Neil Peart live?
Oh, yes, twice. It's phenomenal. And I saw Buddy Rich before he died, too.
Yeah, absolutely incredible. And what is your favorite Bible verse?
Wow, dude, that's okay. I wasn't prepared for that. My favorite Bible verse. Okay. I'm not going to be able to quote the source. Yeah, I could if I thought about it. I have a favorite verse about the day will come when the children of God will be able to come to the waters of life and they will be able to drink freely. And in that day, when you can drink from the waters of life freely, it says God will take out your stony heart and he will give you a heart of flesh. And it says once you have the heart of flesh, you will weep for the person you were in the sight of God during your lifetime. And you will weep and you will mourn like someone mourning their only child for I'm paraphrasing here, for what a scumbag you were in the sight of God just being a sinner. And it says, you will mourn so much you won't even want to be called by your name, and I will give you a new name in that day. And in that day, you will have a new name, and you will have a new heart, and you will be a new person. And you'll be, like I said, I'm paraphrasing, but you'll be my son, I'll be your father. Everything will be great. You'll be made new. And it says it'll be that's my favorite scripture. It'll be as impossible for you to sin in that day as it is for you to do righteousness now. And I think that's pretty awesome. God's basically saying, you're going to screw up. You're a sinner. You're a scumbag. And there's nothing you can do about it. And there will come the day when I will make you new and you won't be able to sin. And it'll be as impossible for you to sin as it is for you to do righteousness now. And I think that justifies all of mankind. I think that's just an amazing scripture. I think it's Jeremiah. I'll have to look it up.
Have you met, I promise this is the final one. Have you ever met someone as good as...
Let me turn my AC off. Give me just one second.
Okay. Just want to let you know you can find Waco, A Survivor Story by David Thibodeau in the link below in the description. I have a link to Amazon. So have you ever met someone as good as David at conveying the message?
No, never, never. I'm glad you brought that up because I was super hyper aware of people that were teaching scripture. All the TV preachers, I would watch them as a kid and wonder why people didn't see through them. I would watch them as a kid and go, how could people send these guys their money? It's just so fake. And again, I hope I'm not offending people that have sent money to TV preachers, but to me, it just seemed very, very fake. When I first moved to Hollywood, I went to music school out there, and the Scientology building was right on the corner of my school. And I would pass by every day, and they'd go, free personality test, free test. Would you like a free test? And there was a guy in a bow tie. I'll never forget him. And I'd just be like, no, I don't have a personality, pal. You know, we got snappy little things we would say to them. And I just always saw through it. A bunch of people showed up with, you know, like all the girls had the same skirts on, all the boys had the same shirts on and the same pants. And I'm just like, wow, that's just that's some kind of sect. I don't like to use the word cult. But the point is, I was hypersensitive because I didn't want to get involved in a cult or a group or a religious thing, even the Hare Krishnas, anything, you know, any of those groups. That wasn't my thing. And so when I met David and Steve at Guitar Center on Sunset Boulevard, after we talked a little bit, they just said that they had some knowledge about the scripture. They didn't preach to me. They had ripped the Bible apart from Genesis to Revelation. They really knew something about it. They treated it as a study. And to me, that's what was fascinating. They weren't saying, just believe this or just believe that, or you have to believe me. It's like, what does it say? They just approached it differently. And I thought that was interesting. So, and they actually interviewed a bunch of my friends when all of this first happened. And they said, so did you ever see David Thibodeau in a cult or in a group like this? And just about every one of the people that they interviewed that knew me said, David Thibodeau is the last person I ever saw ending up in a group like this. And that's kind of true. You know, they like to make it sound like, oh, we were sheep and we had to be led and we were looking for a strong leader. That's maybe the case in a few of the people, but certainly not the majority. Wayne Martin was a Harvard-educated attorney. Steve Schneider taught comparative religions at the University of Hawaii. You know, there were other people. Most of the people that I knew here were very, very intelligent. Let me just put it that way. And they were not sheeple at all.
Well, David, thank you so much for taking the time today. I really appreciate it. And thank you to everyone else for watching.
Thanks, buddy. Appreciate it, man. Take care.